Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Today we're going to be talking with Peter Lowe. He's an attorney with Brown and Isaacson, and he's going to be talking about labor and employment law changes in 2012. So, Peter, thank you for being here today.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here again, Dave.
No, you know, it's funny. I remember you were our first guest on the HR Power Hour way back in July, and we talked about the Penn State scandal back then.
And things have only improved in the show since my appearance.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it very much. And so, you know, you were a great hit, and we're bringing you back. And today we're going to be talking about the 2012 Employment Law Review. This is something that's certainly done by attorneys a lot in January of each year, as we recap on that. I know you have done a bunch of them here in the state and have done it for a number of the SHRM groups. Tell me a little about how this got started in terms of why it's kind of done at the beginning of every year and not maybe halfway through or towards the end.
Yeah, towards the end of the year, I get requests from organizations like the SHRM affiliates. Central Maine one is a group that I've done the annual update for 7-8 years now, and clients as well. And so much happens in the employment law world. It's a dynamic area, and folks are very knowledgeable, HR professionals, managers, and others, but they want to be kept up to speed. And so I found there's a good audience for getting people together once a year, usually January, February, and saying what happened in the last year and trying to make it interesting, interactive, and relevant to them and their jobs.
Well, I think that it's certainly an important area, especially since HR professionals deal with things every day, and they may not be keeping up constantly on what has changed. I mean, that's the reality is they have a day job to do. And so I think that it's important for them to know that these are updates that can affect them. And in their quest to be compliant, and sometimes knowing what to do and how to handle it, they can certainly pick up the phone and call a good attorney, but sometimes it's just some basic knowledge that they need to know.
Right. And I don't know about you, but I get so many things that cross, I used to say the desk, but now the screen, newsletters, updates, bulletins, alerts, and you only have so much time. So we read some of them, a lot of them we don't get to, and this is an opportunity, you know, once a year to have somebody really digest it for you, do it in, hopefully a clear manner, and folks can take something away and help improve their practice.
Well, that's great, because what we're certainly going to do today is put it on the air, and I think that that's something that, you know, people will be interested to hear about. HR professionals who can't necessarily go to these groups or business professionals who don't have the time to necessarily do that can listen to it. They certainly can go to hrpowerhour.com and download this and save it or podcast it when they need to do, get that update. So let's talk a little about the first one. So we'll bring it up. Limitations on using applicant criminal histories. So, Peter, that's an awful long title. But then again, it's written by a lawyer. Not surprising. And for those guests out there who don't know, Peter and I have spoken many, many times together. So we like to banter a little. So just be aware of that. But tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you've given me a list of the things that I can't talk about today. So so if you get too fresh, I'll go to those in a minute.
Nice, but, nice.
Well, yes, one of the topics that I've been already talking about with folks and plan to in the next few months is what employers are doing for criminal background checks and screening. And when you hear what I've got to say, it's like the Full Lawyers Employment Act, because on the plus side, we want to encourage our employers to do criminal background checks. You know, we're obviously sitting here in the wake of another act of violence, this time not by an employer, but if you look at the history, one of the most common places for these types of awful random massacres can be in the workplace. the employee who is disgruntled, the former employee. Criminal background checks are not going to be the sole solution to preventing workplace violence, but it certainly helps.
It's a tool in the arsenal, right?
It's a tool in the arsenal. You don't want to find out that you inadvertently hired a violent felon, and if you had done a routine, relatively low-cost background check, you would have identified that. So that's pretty obvious to people. That's not earth-shattering news in 2012. Where the new development has occurred or attention on an existing issue is from the federal government. And the federal government have put out through the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they put out some very detailed guidelines this year. And they've explained that one priority for them is vetting the employers who do criminal background checks to ensure that the criminal background checks are not having a discriminatory impact on a particular group or, as we might say, protected class of employees. So the good news is we're doing the criminal background check and we're avoiding liability, trying to avoid liability from hiring violent or dishonest people. The flip side of it is we're doing background checks and the federal government may say that those are discriminatory and we're going to have liability for not hiring somebody, the proverbial rock and the hard place. Mm-hmm. But you know, we talk to clients about this issue and there's a way to thread the needle.
What is the process then? First of all, I guess the question would be, we've always said that if you're going to do background checks, you have to do them for everybody. And I'm assuming that still applies, that you want to be consistent across the board, that if you're hiring for a position and you get to a certain stage in the process, that you want to make sure that you're doing it for all applicants that are coming in that may have crossed a certain threshold in terms of being maybe the final applicants for a position.
Right, right. Yeah, it certainly doesn't need to be done for everybody in the applicant pool. But when you get to the stage of job offers, that's the time where many employers today will condition a job offer on a number of contingencies. Sometimes it's a medical screening. Frequently, it's passing a criminal background check. The question is, what does passing a criminal background check mean?
So, is there new definitions for that? What is the actual, federal impact on this process?
Yeah. The number one thing that employers should not do, and I agree with the EEOC on this part, having a policy that simply says, if you have any criminal history whatsoever, we're not going to hire you. It sounds clean. It sounds simple. It sounds consistent. However, certainly the federal government and potentially courts could look at that policy and say that it is too broad and has a discriminatory impact. Let me just sort of put flesh on the bones, if you like, so folks can understand what I mean by that. A really easy example or an easier example is if you were to rely on arrest data versus conviction data. Arrest data is available and out there. However, we all know that the fact that you've been arrested doesn't mean you've committed a crime. The statistics are revealing in this regard. If you live in certain locations, you may have a far higher chance of being arrested than you do in other locations. So an urban inner city environment, much higher arrest rates. Males have higher arrest rates. African-American males have higher arrest rates. Hispanic males have higher arrest rates. And the EEOC, in its document that it issued this year, and you get it from its website, spells that out in a lot of detail and gives you the numbers. I'm not going to go through those now. But the theory is, if you were to screen out everybody who has a history of being arrested, while you may not intend to discriminate, you may unintentionally have a disparate impact on a class or group of individuals. Let's say it's Hispanic males, young Hispanic males. The EEOC says that you can be liable for a policy, a screening policy that's too broad and has that impact. So one simple measure, and I advise all clients of this, is you shouldn't be relying on arrest data. And when you rely on conviction data, so the person has been convicted, that includes pleading guilty, you should consider some factors. One factor being, what was the nature of the crime? Number two, how long ago was the crime committed? And three, what is the nature of the job you're hiring for?
Okay, so now I have the question that I'm sure when people are listening to that go, nature of the crime. All right, so am I being the judge and jury of me being the hiring person? I determine from an organizational standpoint, an individual standpoint, what a good nature of a crime is, what a bad nature of a crime is. How do you define that so that somebody would say, hey, you know, well, robbery, not acceptable. Breaking and entering, not acceptable. Murder, not acceptable. But, you know, assault because it was just grabbing somebody's arm. Well, what's the definition? I mean, I'm trying to understand how somebody in the HR or business world could say, what's the nature of the crime and how would you really define that?
Well, here in Maine, we classify crimes on a system of A through E. And A, B, and C are felonies. D and E are misdemeanors. And I think a well-written policy, you know how we love our policies, but anybody who's doing criminal background checks needs to have a policy that explains how they assess the folks that have convictions. And one way to do that is to say, if you had a felony, class A, B, or C in the last 5 years, then this is the outcome. And when you get into what's the nature of the crime, you know, often when people run these background checks, you know, I think what most commonly comes up are OUIs and some drug offenses. If the drug offense is the possession of marijuana when you were 19 and you're now 45 and you've got a clean record, yeah, most likely the nature of that crime is not going to prohibit you from hiring that person. If, in fact, it's a drug crime, but you were a drug kingpin and you were involved in, you know, all sorts of trafficking and you served 12 years of hard time, then you may look at that differently and say, given the nature of the crime, we're not going to take the chance and hire this individual. What the EEOC has said fundamentally is you need to make an individualized decision. And this is an area where there's a real tension, because as lawyers for employers, we're always saying, be consistent, be consistent,
right.
Be
exactly
consistent.
What I'm
you
thinking,
are you
yeah.
are too as a
yeah,
consultant
exactly.
to your
yeah.
clients. And so, you know, we could be charged with being, you know, talking out of both sides of our mouths. I apply the analogy to the ADA, disability issues. You want to have policies that outline what you're going to do to accommodate disabled employees. But the law says you have to do an individualized inquiry about a reasonable accommodation, for example. Same thing, it appears, in the criminal background checks. So I tell folks they want to develop guidelines. The guidelines will talk about, you know, the type of offense. And in the end, it's helpful to write a sentence or two to explain your decision. I decided that Dave would have access to credit card data as a customer service representative. He was convicted of theft 4 years ago, and we determined that that was an unacceptable level of risk. That's an individualized decision. I find, you know, the two criminal offenses that you're going to be most alert to are both crimes of violence and crimes of dishonesty. And what you're doing when you're screening is looking to make sure your workplace is safe and your customers, visitors, clients are safe both physically and in their assets, credit card information, account information,
absolutely. No
all of those things.
About that. You know, I still, as you're talking about it, I think to myself, you know, there does have to be a real discussion about the fact that, okay, is 4 years ago long enough? Is six
right.
years? Is 10? Is 15? Is it back when you were 16, 19 years old? Maybe not 16, but 19 years old. Those are all, you know, important questions that will come up out of this to make
right.
sure that there is at least some sort of methodology used so that you're not just saying, well, I made the decision that in this particular issue it was 5 years, and in this particular issue, you know, it was this. And I do understand the individual nature of this. I do. I get that. But I also can see where there could be some definite risk
right.
in terms of somebody saying, well, you didn't hire me because.
Absolutely. And that's, yeah, that leads to, well, when will this come up for a main employer? It will either come up based on an individual claim where, let's say, an African-American male is not hired and goes to the EEOC or the Maine Human Rights Commission and says, I think it was because of my race, and they check that box off. EEOC, the federal agency who've issued these guidelines, have such a big caseload and so many different issues. They can't possibly give the necessary attention to every issue in every case. So they prioritize. This is one of their issues. This is a priority. So if a case like this shows up, then they're going to pay attention to it. So you're on their radar. And then, you know, they might look further and find out there are other people in a similar situation who didn't get hired by you, and it becomes a bigger issue. You ideally don't want to get the attention of the federal enforcement agencies. You want to stay off their radar. And I think part of our job is to say, what really counts right now for the feds? What are they looking at? What are the issues that they've identified as priorities? This is one of them. So my task has been to make sure clients and folks in the HR and employment community are aware of this. When the feds come knocking on one of these issues, you don't want to say, yeah, we do screenings, and no one would say it quite this way, but the essence would be we kind of make it up as we go along.
Right, exactly.
It's not a place of strength. So instead you say, you know, we have these guidelines, we apply these, and then we make our own individual judgment, and this is the reason we didn't hire Dave or whomever it is. So is there a new law in this area? No. But it's an issue of federal enforcement. And the last thing I would say on this issue is, you know, it really is going to be of an increasing focus. And I think folks really do need to pay attention to it.
No, it's a very important issue. And I think that it's something that people need to be aware of. And we are talking with Peter Lowe, attorney from Brown and Isaacson in Lewiston, Maine. And we just got done talking about the limitations on using applicant criminal histories. You know, one of the other things that play into this when hiring somebody talks a little about drugs. And there has been some changes across the nation in terms of medical marijuana, and actually, for that sake, marijuana in general. How does that play into it? If we could just talk a little bit about that. I know that there's still laws being written on some of these changes. So give us your take on that, please.
Yes, certainly. Well, for listeners, both Dave and I have made a little industry out of presenting to folks, both here in Maine and outside of Maine now, on the whole issue of drugs, alcohol, and in particular medical marijuana in the workplace. And I'm going to spare you the hours or 2 hours that we can talk about that issue, because it's a big issue. Here in Maine, in the last 12 months, there have been no legislative changes. There have yet to be any significant cases that have been reported out here in Maine. And we're really waiting for those, because just a refresher, Maine does have a medical marijuana law, and it has some very specific provisions that relate to the workplace. And at a very high level, the fact that somebody tests positive for marijuana now in a pre-employment screening doesn't mean automatically that you can screen them out and not hire them. If they are a registered medical marijuana user, and statistics show there's more and more of those folks out there in Maine, then you can't simply take the position, we're not going to hire you. It's a complex issue, and if it's a safety-sensitive position, there certainly are fitness for duty concerns and evaluations that need to be done. It becomes, frankly, a medical judgment issue about whether or not a medical marijuana user who tests positive, either in a screening or a random test during employment, can, in fact, be fit to perform the essential functions of the job and do so in a way that doesn't pose a direct threat to the safety of others. You know, the change that has taken place nationally. More states are approving medical marijuana laws. Massachusetts has just approved a medical marijuana law. And as folks probably know, Colorado and Washington State passed a referenda that legalized marijuana, not simply for medical purposes. Both of those states had medical marijuana laws on the books. Now they have marijuana laws on the books. And I read recently that the federal government, again, is in this position of saying, well, we probably won't go after the individual users who are using under state laws that make it legal, even though it is illegal under federal law.
It is the amazing part of the, I mean, we've done this seminar now, gosh, 25, almost 30 times. And at the end of the day, isn't it amazing how many times that question comes up, you know, that hey, it's still federally illegal. And,
yeah.
And they're right. It is. And it's interesting. I do wonder how it's going to play into the fact that now in those states that aren't just medical marijuana, that's just marijuana, how that will play in drug testing and other things for those states. And I'm sure that this will be played out over the next, you know, 6 months and year,
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah.
You know.
And I'm seeing it now filter through. You probably are as well, from some clients. I had a client within the last couple of weeks. The employee was randomly tested under an approved policy here in Maine. The employee works at an elevation, I think, of about 300 feet in the air. And the employee tested positively for medical marijuana or marijuana and revealed it was medical marijuana. So those are the calls you get where, you know, the HR professional says, Peter, just a quick question.
It's always just a quick question.
Just a quick question. Yeah. That means they want a quick, cheap answer. You know how cost-effective we are as,
yes,
as lawyers,
yes,
of course. You know, but the issue then is that person fit for duty?
Right.
It's a medical evaluation again. Right. But I'm seeing it increasingly come through with client questions now. So,
well, no, and it's becoming more and more, and clearly across the country. You know, that this is becoming more and more a question of how are we going to deal with this? How is it, how a workplace is going to deal with this? And what does this have as an effect on the other employees and the safety of employees in the workplace as well? So,
right. And not to get too much into this topic because time is precious, but the other issue that increasingly you and I have been talking about with folks is prescription drugs and the use and abuse of prescription drugs. And we'd be fooling ourselves if we said that isn't an issue in the workplace. It is in society.
It
is here
is.
In Maine.
Yeah.
Therefore, it is in the workplace. And fundamentally, it's a safety issue.
Absolutely. No question about it. All right, we're going to move on to another policy, the social media policy and the NLRA, which is obviously the National Labor Relations Authority. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that people need to look at from their social media policies, some of the changes that are out there, and give us your take on that.
Yeah. When I speak to audiences on this particular issue, social media, I often ask at the beginning of the presentation for a show of hands. And I ask folks who out there has a social media policy and who's thinking of developing a social media policy. And right now, I'd say it's about 50-50. In the last few years, a lot of employers, probably heeding the advice of lawyers and other HR professionals, have said, okay, you know, we need a policy. Give us a policy. We'll develop a policy. Then there are other folks who have said, you know, I don't think we need it. It's not relevant for our organization. We're too small. In any event, that's sort of the state of play. What I have found is that those who develop policies and have policies out there right now based on what the National Labor Relations Board has ruled in a number of cases, I would hazard to guess that the great majority of those policies are considered illegal by the National Labor Relations Board, that they contain language that is, in the view of the federal government, again, too broad, and it infringes upon the rights of employees. So the dutiful employers went out there and developed policies. Good, you have a policy. The bad news, if you like, is your policy almost certainly needs to be reviewed and revised, and that's certainly something we've been doing with clients based on a whole slew of rulings in this area. Remember I said about the EEOC and how they pick an issue that's a priority for them? It's the same with the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board used to be this relatively sleepy federal agency that didn't do an awful lot. That has changed radically in the last 4 years, and social media is one of their pet projects. So there's an abundance of precedent out there now, and it continues to develop. Again, if you're an HR professional, you might see these reports or cases, but it's almost overwhelming in its volume. So my task is to translate that for folks and say, here, this is what you should be paying attention to. These are some of the things I'm recommending in your social media policies.
And we'll be right back.
Are you in sales, or do you own your own business? If so, I want you to think of a number. Think of the amount of money you'd like to make this year. Do you have it? Okay, so what's stopping you? It's not your drive. It's not your skills. Chances are, it's your ability to find new leads. It's not easy. But what if, with one phone call, you could actually get your hands on as many new sales leads as you could handle and actually make that number you have in your head? It's not too good to be true. It's Sales Genie from Info Group, America's leading provider of sales leads, plus money-making email and direct mail solutions. No matter what you're selling or who you're selling to, Sales Genie has the sales leads you need. And right now, they'll give you a free trial just for calling. Call Sales Genie at 1-800-991-8440 and get your free trial. Call 1-800-991-8440. 1-800-991-8440. Again, that's 1-800-991-8440.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Packers.
Vikings.
We come from different places.
Uptown.
Downtown.
We come to different conclusions.
Half empty.
Half full.
But when we live united, we make a real difference in the building blocks of life. Children succeed in school, families gain financial stability, the health of our neighbors improves, and suddenly so do our communities. Real change won't happen without you.
Live united.
So give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Sign up today at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
And we're back on the HR Power Hour, which is presented by Career Management Associates. And we're talking with Peter Lowe, attorney for Braun and Isaacson. Peter, again, thank you for being on the show today. And we're talking about a legal update here. And the area we're speaking about is social media. So let me ask a basic question. What are some of the areas that employers, HR professional, business leaders who may have this policy, what do they need to be aware of? What do they need to be looking at? What are some of the areas that they need to focus on?
Well, I go back sometimes to the purpose of the policies, first of all. And one of the purposes that employers develop policies for is to ensure that there isn't harassment, bullying, and other inappropriate, disrespectful conduct happening on social media. And that's easy to deal with, or relatively easy to deal with, if it's happening at work, on your own systems, on or even on the computer that you provide for an employee. That's relatively simple. Where it's trickier is where all of this conduct is happening outside of work. Someone's at home, they're not working, they're not on the clock, yet they post content on a social media site, Facebook, that is, let's say, highly inappropriate. And the real question is, what is highly inappropriate?
Well, that is the bottom line to this, isn't it?
It really is the bottom line. And just for folks out there, understand that if you're a private sector employer versus a public sector employer, there's a big difference, and namely the First Amendment and constitutional rights for the public sector. So some of my comments are going to be assuming you're in the private sector, you're a private business or organization. So in order to ensure that employers aren't facing harassment cases and making sure that their employees aren't being harassed and being treated respectfully, a lot of people who develop social media policies have said, the rules of the road that apply in the workplace, the rules of conduct apply outside the workplace. And then they go further and they say offensive or inappropriate remarks are as out of place online as they are here in the workplace. If you listen to what I just said, probably most people would nod and say, okay, I get it. That makes sense.
Common sense type statement, sure.
The quote I just gave, I believe, came from the Costco social media policy, you know, huge retailer.
Absolutely.
Lots of resources, HR, lawyers. And the NLRB took a look at that policy and said that was illegal. Ooh, has the world turned upside down? We got one federal agency, the EEOC, saying you can't harass and discriminate and you're going to be sued for that. And then we got another one saying, well, when you place these rules that are intended to prevent harassment, that is also illegal. This does help keep us in business.
No question about that.
On a serious note, what the National Labor Relations Board is saying is employees may see that prohibition and they may consider that to prohibit them from doing some things that they're entitled to do by law. For example, there's a protected right if you're acting in concert, if you're acting together with other employees, to make some complaints about your workplace. There's a protected right to talk about your wages. Some employers have policies that say, you know, your wage information is confidential. That goes too far, in fact. So these references to offensive speech or inappropriate speech or even the term disparaging have run afoul of the feds, and they've said too broad, too vague, that will chill the employees' rights under the National Labor Relations Act to engage in, I'm just getting legalistic here, right, but somewhat in concerted, protected activity. So you've got to make those clearer, and if you're using terms like threatening or violent or discriminatory, that may be okay, but inappropriate is too broad. And there's a sort of a list that I have now of, in one column when I've done a presentation, which are words that the NLRB says they're okay, and then there's words that they say are not okay. Frankly, it's sometimes hard to distinguish, and there isn't a lot of rhyme or reason. So I have a lot of sympathy for employers who are trying to work through this thicket and say, how far can I go? And you know, we give advice in that area to say, here's what a prudent social media policy should look like. And where does this come up again? I mean, I'm a believer in being practical, not just saying to employers there's lots of risk out there. They know it. But how could this come up? The biggest issue would be, of course, if you have a social media policy and you decide that you're going to fire somebody for a social media policy violation. My advice may sound a bit self-serving, but is because of the complexity of these issues now, that's the time to seek legal counsel and make sure that you're not going to run into some of these NLRB issues. or NL, you know, National Labor Relations Act issues enforced by the board?
Well, there certainly has been a lot of enforcement, or at least a lot of discussion from the NLRB in the last few years that, you know, as you said, has been much more active than they ever have been in the past. Can you give one or two quick tips as to for somebody to say, hey, you know, this as part of the social media policy is something that you shouldn't do. This is something that you can do. Just maybe a quick tip, and then obviously in the essence of time, we will move on to a couple of the other ones that have changed.
Yes. But I think one thing I do always look for is, are there any restrictions on an employee's ability to talk about their working conditions? Are there any restrictions in there that could be construed to prevent them talking about their pay? And then the other issue is, do you have some of these very broad and somewhat vague statements, inappropriate one to really look out for? If you've got that term in your social media policy, you probably want to have it looked at. And the last thing I'd say is, it's not a cure-all, but if you don't have this in your social media policy, you should. And that is a statement that says, by the way, nothing in this policy is intended to impair your rights or limit your rights in any way under federal and state labor laws, and then some other verbiage that goes with that. But it's to tell folks, to tell employees, you're not going to be restricted in talking about your working conditions and organizing and those other things that are protected by law.
No, I think that's good, because certainly blogging and Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and all the other social media sites have just exploded over the last few years. And this is really a big issue for companies that are concerned about making sure that they are, you know, protecting themselves and protecting their image, if you want to say, in the digital world that we are today.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, most employees don't want to restrict their employees' rights. They just want to make sure they're protected at the end of the day.
I mean, last week I had three separate matters where clients called me about the social media activities of their employees. Are they monitoring it? Of course they're not. But where it becomes the employer's business is when it spills over. So in one instance, two employees were sharing a lot of information together of a very personal nature. I'll leave it at that. And fine, you usually can do that. If you're in a reporting relationship, not such a good idea, but two coworkers did it. But inevitably, at some point, it spills over into work. People start to talk about it. One of them talks about it. Somebody else talks about it. And then it becomes our business. And my clients face this issue because someone walks into their office and they've printed out something from Facebook and they say, have you seen this? And all of a sudden, it becomes the employer's business, and you have to deal with it. If you do that without any guidance, that's a bit of a challenge, guidance being a policy. So,
yes. No, you're absolutely right.
And of course, you know, you and I are from a slightly different generation that didn't grow up with social media. The folks who, you know, we're now hiring and bringing in who are graduating from college or high school, of course, they live and breathe it. So state the obvious. It's just going to become a part of our workplace.
Absolutely. Well, talking about something that has changed over time and certainly in some ways has some generational effect, let's talk about marriage equality. And, you know, it seems obvious that we should be treating spouses the same in the face of conflicting laws. But, you know, there's now a big push across the country with same-sex marriage. You know, it's now, of course, legal in Maine. It has been in across the country in many different states, but it does change some things, even though it is still not recognized by the federal government as something that is quote unquote legal. So can you kind of give us a little bit of the challenges with this? Maybe you can certainly give an example or something in terms of what it may affect, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, sure. One thing I'll disclose to all your listeners is I'm not a benefits lawyer, so and there are some complex benefits issues, so certainly don't rely on me in that area. Yes, the marriage equality law passed by referendum in Maine, and I think in January same-sex couples will be able to marry here in Maine. What employers want to be sure that they're doing is where a right is given to a spouse or to an employee based upon a relationship with a spouse, that, of course, whether it's a opposite-sex couple or same-sex couple, you're going to want to treat them exactly the same. So there are Maine laws a little bit complicated in this area because Maine, in some instances, had already recognized domestic partners for some leave purposes, for example. But you know, I'll give you an example. Maine has its own family medical leave law in addition to the federal one. Sometimes the Maine one applies when the federal doesn't. The term spouse is used in the Maine law. Right now, it's defined as meaning a husband or wife. I think that's the term used. I would certainly advise everybody that with the new law, that you consider a spouse to be, as I said, either a same-sex couple or an opposite-sex couple. And there are other leave laws. There's a domestic violence leave law here in Maine. There's a family care leave law. And often the spouse is included as, you know, the dependent in those laws. So those are some of the things. On a very high level, you've got this problem or difference between the federal law and the state law. Remember the marijuana discussion?
Yes, absolutely. Some of it's all part of it.
There's something called the Defense of Marriage Act,
yeah.
A federal law. And the Supreme Court just announced within the last month, I think, that they're going to take up a case involving the Defense of Marriage Act. So in this term of the Supreme Court, we will learn whether or not, I expect whether that's constitutional or not. It's been challenged on constitutional grounds. So stay tuned on those issues. There's going to be more developments. It's an area which I think we'll just see more and more legislative activity, but probably on a federal and state level. And also, inevitably, we're going to get some litigation and cases on that area.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, this certainly applies a lot to the benefits area, you know, in terms of defining a spouse. But I certainly think this is an area that needs to be covered and something that we need to deal with. So, Peter, I got to tell you, there are a number of what I would call issues that I'd like to get through here, which don't have a lot of changes, but have some minimal changes that I'd like to talk about. And I think it'd be important to let the listeners know. The first one would be independent contractors. And I realize it may be a little bit of a challenge for you to be brief on each of these, but I would appreciate that. Of course, there's the humor of the day.
Yeah, you're putting me on the clock, aren't you?
I am. I'm going to put you on the clock. Maybe I should have done that at the beginning, yeah. But we're going to continue with that.
You know, when you do presentations and you get the evaluations afterwards, but the one thing that I sometimes see is he didn't quite finish on time. So the last time I took that very personally, and I nailed it to the second. So that's my newfound resolution.
Well, that will be not only wonderful, but it will be a Christmas miracle. And since we just went through Christmas, maybe the new year will start that way. We'll see what happens. All right, let's go to the first one. Independent contract issues.
All right. Changes in Maine law taking effect right at the beginning of this year, January. And what Maine law has done is take two tests, one that applied to workers' comp and one that applied to unemployment, and merge the two. And there's a standardized definition effective right at the end of 2012. And what it does at a very high level is say, here are some of the required elements for you to satisfy in order to be an independent contractor. And then there's another list in, I think there's 7 or 8 factors on that list, and you have to meet at least 3 of them. I'm not going to, for your listeners, read through all of those. What I like to say to people is when you're facing this issue of independent contractor versus employee, the question I always pose is, without your business, does the person have a business? So There you are, keeping it simple as a lawyer.
No, that's great.
Ask that question always. Then you may delve into more details, but that's a key question. And one other comment, priority issue for the federal government again. They've hired a lot of investigators, auditors in this area, and the federal agencies are cooperating with each other now. So if you get into problems with the Department of Labor, you might also get into problems with the IRS. It's possible that you'll hear from not one but two of the agencies if you have these problems.
Both agencies you do not want to find on your front doorstep.
Ideally not.
Absolutely not. Okay, so the second one would be no-fault attendance policies. Tell me about the changes there.
Yeah, this is more an issue of emphasis. The law has not changed in this area, but the EEOC, yet again, have made it clear. I was listening to one of their directors the other day, and she said, this is a big issue for us. And big employers, again, you know, somebody as sophisticated as Verizon in terms of their infrastructure ended up paying $20 million to settle a case, which was a class action, I believe. But nutshell, here's the issue. If you have a strict no-fault attendance policy that says after you've missed work 10 times in the last year, you're terminated, you may have problems. There may be some absences in that no-fault policy that, in fact, are, quote, protected by law, maybe by the ADA, maybe by the Federal Family Medical Leave Act, the main leave act. The other area for folks to be really careful about is if you give a certain amount of medical leave to your employees, 6 months, for example, if you always end the employment of anybody who exhausts that 6 months automatically saying, sorry, your leave is out, then the federal government may come after you, or individual plaintiff's lawyers may come after you and say that policy is illegal. That's the view they've taken. And they're saying, again, at the end of a fixed period of leave, you should do an individualized assessment to determine whether the person may be coming back in the next few weeks.
In talking with you, obviously, about this, you talked a little bit about protected absences, which is, you know, the employers could identify protected absences. Don't count them, for example, you use as a term. Could you give a little bit of a definition of what a protected absence is versus a, if you want to do the opposite, non-protected absence?
Yeah. This is one of the areas where HR people call me and I tease them about it. She says, oh, this is such a tricky area. Can you call me about something plain and simple like harassment? If I suffer from migraines and I have qualified for FMLA and I miss days episodically or intermittently and you have a no-fault attendance policy and I get to 10 and let's say 3 of those days were my migraine days, then those migraine days should not be counted. Those are so-called protected if they are covered and the person's gone through the proper steps of obtaining approval for FMLA. The HR people out there will know it. It's called intermittent FMLA. It's a big challenge for especially small businesses because you get up to 12 weeks in a calendar year or in a 12-month period. And that's a lot of intermittent leave days.
That at least gives a definition for people to look at and have them kind of understand. One last topic, and certainly you talked about the fact that in the last quarter last year, we certainly had the situation that happened in Connecticut. And a lot of people have asked about gun laws. And certainly in Maine, there has been, and across the nation, there are questions about employers and what their rights are in terms of allowing and not allowing based upon the laws that are out there for gun laws. Could you give just a quick overview of anything that may have changed, knowing that right now we're in the midst here in January of the commission being looked at and who knows what new laws will be, but what can employers do, can't do, depending, I realize, on the state?
Yeah. Let's talk about Maine, of course. And here in Maine, in 2011, I believe the law was passed, maybe with some amendments in 2012, that gave employees some rights with respect to bringing weapons at least onto the property of the employer. And that's a specific law that allows somebody who has a concealed weapons permit to bring that weapon, that gun, onto the property of their employer if it's in their vehicle, if it's not in sight, and if it's locked, and they have to have a permit. That was a hard-fought piece of legislation. The business community was strongly opposed. The chamber did a lot of lobbying against it, and in the end, they were unsuccessful. Around the states, until at least this most recent terrible event, there has been efforts to expand the zones where employees may bring guns. Even some folks advocating that guns should be permitted in schools, and you know, clearly that would be an extremely hot button political issue. As of today, the law here in Maine is certainly beyond the parking lot and your own car. An employer may prohibit an employee from bringing any form of weapon, including a gun, into the facility, into the building. And most of my clients have that written down in policies that say that. Some policies have needed changing to reflect that, what I call parking lot change. And so, the message that I would send right now is take a look at that particular policy. Look to see whether it needs strengthening in any way, if you think it needs strengthening. If you don't have that particular provision with respect to the parking lots, you probably should have it. And we'll see as legislation moves forward, both on the federal level and possibly the state level, whether there are any other changes that impact employees. You know, employers and employees, it's the rock and the hard place. We've got rights that we've got to respect of the employees, but of course, if there is a tragic event and there's an allegation that the employer was negligent and didn't keep the workplace safe, then the employer is going to face legal issues that way, as well as, you know, the terrible tragedy and cost of an instance of workplace violence. It's an issue that's not going to go away.
Thank you for the update on that. Peter, I got to thank you very much for coming in and sharing this with us today. You always do a great job, and hopefully have you on again next year at this time, and maybe, who knows, maybe another time during the year. But I appreciate it very much, and I appreciate you giving this information out to everybody.
I appreciate it. It's great to be on again. Thanks, Dave.
And now the HR tip of the week. Have you thought about training your managers and supervisors how to properly terminate employees? Why is this a problem? Well, sometimes terminations are done in haste without thinking about the ramifications. It is important to make sure that you have consistency in your process. And that's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking to Jerry LaBelle. He's a nurse practitioner for WorkMed at St. Mary's Hospital up in Auburn, Maine. We're going to be talking about aging workforce trends, how they really impact you today. Second, we're going to be talking with Susan Dench. She is the author of The Responsibility Rules. She's going to be talking about personal responsibility in the workplace, how it impacts employers and employees. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 2 p.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.